Live from Earth, it's Space Radio. This is Paul Sutter, and coming up, we're talking about waking up to the cosmic dawn. Do all galaxies host black hearts? And sorry about irradiating you. And of course, taking listener questions about all things, well, all things, because this show is about the entire universe. We record every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern. So call 888-581-0708 to join the conversation. And in today's Blue Shift, I'll be talking about Planet 9 from outer space. I did that effect myself. Thank you very much. But first, the news. Hello, space fans. Welcome to Space Radio. I'm Paul Sutter, astrophysicist at Ohio State, chief scientist at COSIME for the next half hour, your agent of the stars. We've got an exciting show for you today on Space Radio, where we talk about all things space, astronomy, astrophysics, rocketry, if it's above the Earth's atmosphere, and sometimes in it, it's in this show's universe. This show lives on listener questions. We record every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern here in Studio A of WCB Radio Columbus. So take a note, make a recording, remind yourself to call 888-581-0708. You can also follow along on our live streams on YouTube, Facebook, and Twitch. Check out spaceradioshow.com for all the links. You can also follow me on social media. My name is at Paul Matt Sutter on all channels. We'll take questions you send there too. Seriously, folks, I've only prepped 10 minutes of show material tops, so get those calls in. Actually, I may have lied. There is so much astronomy news going on that I may not even make it to the calls today just because it is so. This has been a busy week. It's been a busy week for space and spacey-like things. And probably the top news just broke yesterday, which yesterday for me is Wednesday. Yesterday for you might be, I don't know, a different day of the week, a different year, a different millennium. Yesterday for me was February 28th of 2018. And it's big news, and I like the news, and I'm going to talk about the news and the meaning behind the news and what this potential result could mean. I also think that all the headlines and the story that's being attached to this news are taking the wrong direction. I think there's something even cooler going on that's not making it to the front page, it's not making it to the headlines, and I don't blame the press releases or the journalists for taking this particular tack with the news article, because the actual science article takes the same tag. It's in the abstract of the article itself. So of course, all the news is going to report on this juicy bit at the end of the abstract. But I think when it comes to this news, and don't worry, I'm going to explain it all so what I'm saying actually makes sense, but I want to set some context here. I think we're missing the forest for the trees in what's being covered and what's being focused on with this announcement. And I know I'm going to have to take more time than usual just to dig into unpack this. So let's do it. The result is, you may have heard that we have finally seen some light from the first stars in the universe. And that light is telling us something funny. It's telling us something about the behavior of dark matter in the early universe. That's the result. It's a Nature article led by Judd Bowman of Arizona State University. And I think there's a lot of different directions in this news story to take and a lot of things to unpack, because basically every other word in that sentence, in that high level summary, is pretty awesome and also pretty technical and pretty jargony. The headline, what I just said, is that we're seeing light from the very early universe. It's telling us about the properties of the gas that's just hanging out between the stars, doing its thing, minding its own business. It's telling us about the gas in the early universe. That gas is twice as cold as we expected. And one possible way to explain it, and the explanation that best fits the data, according to the observers and all the people they collaborated with, is that dark matter, this mysterious component that makes up the most of the mass of the universe, is somehow interacting with normal matter. And back in the day, you know, 13 billion years ago, it was doing this interaction more intensely and then not so much nowadays. And so maybe this is a detection of dark matter, this mysterious substance that we don't fully understand. Maybe it's telling us something about this massive component of the universe that hardly ever talks to normal matter, but maybe normal matter and dark matter were BFFs 13 billion years ago, and this is the signal that we're getting. I don't think so. We're going to take a quick, tiny little break, and then instead of taking a caller, I want to dig right into this a little bit more.
The latest news, inspiration, along with laughs and trivia from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me are yours for the weekend. Just say, Alexa, play NPR, and enjoy your break.
Remember, you are listening to Space Radio. If you have questions about this, if you want to talk about it, even if it's like 3 weeks later and you're still curious about it, feel free to call in. That's 888-581-0708 or join the live streams on YouTube and Facebook. So what I'm talking about is this new result, Nature paper led by Judd Bowman of Arizona State University and also Salim Zerubi of Groningen, University of Groningen in the Netherlands, about this detection of early light from the very early universe and what it might tell us about dark matter. And so, of course, all the headlines are focusing on the dark matter because the line of evidence, if you believe this result and what it tells us about dark matter, then this is like the most significant thing we've learned about dark matter in a very, very, very long time. We've been trying to hunt for dark matter. We've been trying to pin down the properties of dark matter. And it's been a slow, gradual chipping away at the properties of, well, maybe dark matter is this. And we go out and test for it. No, that's not it. Oh, I know. Maybe dark matter behaves this way. And then we go out for a test for it. No, it's not like that. We're slowly pinning down, honing in on what the dark matter actually could be. And then this result comes out of nowhere and says, oh, yeah, by the way, 13 billion years ago, dark matter was all over the place and interacting with normal matter to such a degree that normal matter could lose some energy to the dark matter, cool itself off, and that's what explains our observations. This gas in the early universe is twice as cool as we expect it to be. And we've tested everything else. We've tested all sorts of other astrophysical models. We tested our experiment, our detector, to make sure we weren't just measuring emission from the microwave in the visitor center, which has happened before. That's a really fun story, but a story for another day. We tested it, and this is the result we get. And it's a really strong result, and we're sticking by it. So yeah, the news is, of course, focusing on the dark matter. I want to focus on something else, because I'm pretty sure, I'm going to go ahead and say it, I'm pretty sure that the signal itself is twice as strong as we expect it to be. It's twice as cold as we expect it to be. I'm pretty sure with future measurements, that is going to go away. That's going to melt. That is going to shift around within the uncertainties. And I don't think we're going to learn a lot about dark matter from this observation. That said, this is an incredible observation. This is an incredible result. Not for what it tells us, maybe or maybe not, about dark matter, but the fact that the result exists at all in the first place. There is a huge gap in our knowledge of the early universe, a tremendous gap. We have incredible knowledge of the present day universe. We can look around our own galaxy. We can look at nearby galaxies. We can measure their properties and their positions and their speeds. We can go out pretty far with our galaxy surveys, back to when the universe was maybe 10 billion years old. By the way, the universe is currently 13.77 plus or minus 1, I think, billion years old. And the farther back we look in distance, the farther back we look in time. So the further the object you see, you're seeing the universe as it was in younger and younger states. So we see the present day universe. We have a kind of good handle on the middle-aged universe. We see, you know, the universe was like half its present age, kind of, sort of, decently. We're starting to get some decent surveys and some decent probes. And we see the incredibly early universe. We see it basically the baby universe. We have what's called the cosmic microwave background. It's leftover light from the Big Bang itself that totally saturates the universe. You can't see it with your eyeballs because it's in the microwave. But if you were to put on your microwave goggles, it would be totally all over the sky. It totally inundates us. And that was released when the universe was a mere 370,000 years old, which in human terms, that's if we had a baby picture of you when you were only 7 seconds old. So when it comes to cosmology, when it comes to these deep surveys, we have a picture of the universe when it was 7 years old. We have some kind of sort of hints of when the universe is like 10 years old or 12 years old. We have some decent surveys of when the universe is in college, 20 years old, 25 years old, first getting its job. And then we have the present day, mature, has a mortgage, a family, a couple cars. We have that present day picture of the universe when it's nice and old. And we have a couple snapshots of the middle, younger universe. And then we have this beautiful baby picture, this exquisite image from the incredibly early universe when the universe was just 7 seconds old. But what about all the parts in between? What happened to the universe between age 7 seconds and age, say, 10 years? There's a lot going on that we don't have pictures of until now. I'm Paul Sutter. This is Space Radio. This show is brought to you by you. Visit patreon.com/PM Sutter. It's your efforts, your contributions that are keeping this show running and this show on the air. I'd especially like to thank Robert R. for his generous contributions this month. See you after the break.
You'll never be as young as you are today, so don't waste another moment not attending to the most important brand in your life, You Inc. Join me, Rhea Greif, Saturdays at 2:30 p.m. to meet the grand dame of contemporary art, Marlena Keynes, owner of the Hammond Harkins Gallery, and how she took art from the basement of her parents' clothing store to the halls of the Museum of Art. That's You Inc. every Saturday at 2:30 p.m. on Central Ohio's NPR station 90.5 WCBE.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm Paul Sutter, and this is Space Radio. I'm compelled to talk about this incredible result that was just released to the public yesterday my time, about detecting light from the first stars in the universe and what it might tell us about dark matter. We have exquisite images of the incredibly young universe when the universe was 7 seconds old. When the universe was 370,000 years old, but in human terms for this metaphor, it's as if we have a picture of the universe when it was 7 seconds old. We also have pictures, exquisite pictures of the present day universe and when the universe was a little bit older. We don't have images. We don't have data of the young, the infant universe. We don't have data of when the first stars were born. We don't have data of when the first galaxies began forming. We only have information after that. And the challenge here, the reason we don't have that information until now, is that the universe was neutral. The universe was made of neutral hydrogen, neutral helium, a little bit of lithium. Neutral gas doesn't glow very brightly. You need to excite it. You need to energize it. You need to ionize it to get some solid radiation out of there. And what little light is emitted is so dang far away, it's kind of hard to take a picture of it, even with a giant telescope. So we're a little bit stuck. We have the James Webb Space Telescope coming up in a few years, although there was, looks like it's going to get delayed again. That's a story I was going to talk about. Maybe I'll save it till next week. James Webb Space Telescope is designed to go hunting for those first generation of galaxies, those young stars to appear in our universe, try to get some decent pictures, some decent data from those epochs of our early universe. But, you know, we don't have the James Webb yet. So what can we do? What can we do to study what we call the dark ages of the universe, the age before stars? What can we do to study what we call the cosmic dawn, when the first stars began to ignite and come on the scene? What can we do to study the formation of the first galaxies to appear in our universe? Well, we can turn to a strange quirk of neutral gas. If you take neutral gas, neutral hydrogen, plain vanilla, the simplest atom in the universe, neutral hydrogen, there is a strange effect in quantum mechanics where the electron and proton, which comprise the hydrogen, you know, the electrons that's in a shell around the proton nucleus, they're spinning. Well, they have a property called quantum mechanical spin. And usually their spins are opposite. That's the way they like it. Every once in a while, totally randomly, because of life of quantum mechanics, they can flip so that they have the same spin direction. And then they'll flip back the way they like it to be opposite spin directions. When they do that, they emit light. That light has a very, very precise wavelength. It is 21 centimeters. 21 centimeters. If you hold out your hands about yay big, like say you're telling someone like, hey, I caught a fish and it was yay big. That's about 21 centimeters. Neutral hydrogen gas emits light of a very, very specific wavelength of 21 centimeters. Now, when it was emitted, it was 21 centimeters long, but that was a long time ago. The universe has expanded. That light has redshifted all the way down into radio. So when this light from the very early universe that's emitted at 21 centimeters makes it to the Earth a long time from now, it's like 2 meters across, which is radio. So we are surrounded by this very faint radio fuzz generated in the early universe that is just now reaching our radio telescopes. That can give us, in principle, a map of the very early universe. The challenge is that these frequencies are totally swamped by all sorts of modern day stuff, including technology, including radio broadcasts, and including all sorts of stuff that are happening inside of galaxies, inside nearby galaxies, that overwhelm this signal by like a factor of 10,000 to 1. So there's all this loud radio junk happening in our present day universe, and behind it is this faint whisper from the infant cosmos, telling us something, telling us about the nature of the distribution of matter at large scales in the very, very early universe. There have been attempts for the past 2 or 3 decades to dig out this signal. It is an incredibly challenging technical task. It's easy enough to build a radio telescope. It's very, very hard to do the proper analysis on it, to collect enough data, to sift through that data, to understand all these other sources of emission so you can hear that faint whisper from the early universe. And this mission, this telescope, which was operated in Australia, called the EDGES telescope, and I totally forget what EDGES stands for. It's a bunch of chicken wire. It's a bunch of radio antenna. It doesn't look all that fancy. It looks like a little wire box, and that's about it. But this little wire box in the desert of Western Australia has perhaps the very first detection from the early universe, from the baby universe, from the era of the cosmic dawn, from the era of when the first stars began to appear on the scene. And to me, that is a huge story. That is a tremendous achievement. We are on the cusp of unlocking a brand new frontier in cosmology, of understanding the fundamental components of our universe, because now this wealth of information is finally reveal to us. We've pulled back the curtain and we can start to see what the universe looked like when it was an infant, when it was a toddler, when it finally got potty trained, when it went to kindergarten. This is important developmental stuff that is currently missing from our cosmological picture. I guarantee there are going to be surprises. This first result contains a potential surprise. It may tell us that dark matter is behaving in a way that we didn't expect and is probably in conflict with all the other ways that we understand dark matter to behave. I'm pretty sure that is going to go away over the next couple of years as other detectors either confirm or deny this result and go after similar observations. I feel like that part is going to fade away. What's going to last is that if this detection holds up, they've done it. They have begun the process of unlocking the cosmic dawn, the dark ages, the early parts of our universe. And to me, that is a big deal. And I think that is a bigger deal than what it might tell us about dark matter. Sorry to go on. I'm not sorry, not sorry to go on this discussion because it's such a big result. And I feel like all the news articles that are representing and telling this story are focusing on the wrong thing. Don't miss the forest for the trees. We're almost out of time on Space Radio, but before we go, it's time for the Blue Shift. I'm Paul Sutter, and you're listening to Space Radio, and this is the Blue Shift. And I want to make one quick announcement. If you're in the Columbus area, then Wednesday, March 9th, you need to go to COSI. There's a public event being held, sponsored by OSU. Mike Brown, the author of Planet Nine from Outer, or he's giving a talk called Planet Nine from Outer Space. He's the author of How I Killed Pluto and Why I Had It Coming. Fantastic scientist, very interesting dude, argues that Pluto should not be a planet. If you want to argue with him in his face, March 9th, you need to go to COSI. Go to go.osu.edu/planet9, planet9. And there'll be a link. You need a ticket to get in. It's absolutely 100% free, but you still need a ticket. That's the quick thing I wanted to announce. There's some other news in the science and science communication world that I feel compelled to talk about because it's such a big deal. Lawrence Krauss, you may know him. He's a professor at Arizona State, author, speaking gigs all the time, on TV a lot, talks about science. It's come out that there's been 2 decades worth of harassment allegations to younger colleagues, which is horrible. And it's horrible not just for the lives he's destroyed and these young women who were interested in careers in science or science communication were meeting an idol and end up having incredibly negative and life-altering encounters with him. And it's rough because I want to do justice to those victims and I want to support them. And I absolutely 100% do. But there's also another story here, which is science communication is hard. Scientists are operating, I believe, on a trust deficit with the public where they don't always trust what scientists have to say and where we're coming from and the way we approach the world and problem solving. And this kind of stuff just makes it worse because now we've got creepazoids running around representing science, representing scientists that are also horrible monsters that are preying on vulnerable young people. And we have to purge them from our community, of course. And we also have to defend ourselves to the public and say, oh yeah, by the way, we're not all creepers. And we're doing our best to flush out the creepers among us to make sure they never rise to prominence. They never get in positions where they can harm young people. And you're just gonna have to trust this. And so thank you, Lawrence, for destroying some people's lives and for making my job harder. That was sarcasm, by the way. If you may not know, I'm not really thankful to him. In fact, I'm resentful. And unfortunately, this broadcast is almost done. Thank you for joining me on this voyage of space radio. Once again, I'm Paul Sutter, and this show is brought to you by the Ohio State University Department of Astronomy. Learn more at astronomy.osu.edu. This show is also brought to you by you. Visit patreon.com/pmsutter to learn how you can contribute. Thanks to Greg Mobius for producing, Dan Michalka for being awesome, and of all the fine crew at WCBE Radio for making this show possible. We record this show every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern. Call 888-581-0708 to join me on the air. You can also catch the Facebook and YouTube and Twitch live streams. You can also follow me on social media. Go to spaceradioshow.com for all those links. Thanks again, Earthlings, for listening. See you next week. And remember, science is for sharing. End of transmission.